How odd that this primary source document says Weekly World News on it.
That boy just married Paris Hilton to the Loch Ness Monster. We gotta go, boys. Things are afoot.
Welcome to the Commentary Track, a Kamen Rider podcast. I'm your host, Jared.
I'm Cody.
And I'm producer, Jed.
Welcome back, boys. Not nearly as much of a gap for us this time.
No, not nearly as long.
It is nice to get a little refresher in between episodes so we can kick it off. You know, sometimes I feel like if we do a bunch in a row, we don't quite have it together, or we like burn out. We use all our funny in the first couple of episodes, and the last one's just like, this is the thing we watched. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, meanwhile, last week, oh God, what are we going to do for the cold open? All of these are hilarious.
See, I still really love the idea of doing our clip show where Jetty just has a bunch of out-of-context quotes where we have to figure out which episode they're from or what the context was, or just be publicly embarrassed by the things that we said.
Yeah, that's also probably going to be the first time most of our listeners would be hearing that stuff.
It is true, which would be hilarious. Maybe that's how we get more people on our Patreon.
Maybe. Plug.
So what episode are we watching today, boys?
So we are going to be watching, this is episodes 21 and 22, Secrets and Game.
Ah, Secret Games.
Yes.
Just like that one time at summer camp. Camp.
I hope not.
This one time at band camp. So anyway, speaking of secrets, shall we get right into it?
Sure.
Episodes 21 and 22 are written by Arakawa Naruhisa, with direction by Watanabe Katsuya. They were broadcast on June 25th and July 2nd, 2000. A jump to the sky turns to a rider review.
Okay, so that was a pretty cool episode so far. After the reset last time with our Pump the Brakes episode, our re-rack, this was a nice getting back into things. We had a lot of fun stuff this episode, for sure.
Indeed. So, episode starts off, we're back in Nagano, of all places. And we're on a deserted rural street near the excavation site. And we see Kameyama and another copper in the car. And they say that they are following the supersonic signature that ULF-3, that's Gomagoo.
Good old Father Jose.
Produces when he flies.
I like to think he's like that one X-Man. I think it's Banshee that can fly just by yelling at the ground. My new headcanon as to how he gets around.
I mean, we did see him flap his arms vaguely.
It's quite the upper body workout he's got going on there.
Or echolocation like a bat.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that's not what I'm here for. So he screams at the ground to travel.
So they're following this supersonic signature on, I guess, all of the cop cars are now equipped with a variation of, that'd be, what, sonar?
Yeah, the ability to pick up sound. Just some sort of acoustic detection.
And we get a jump scare. Gomagoo jumps on the hood of the car. Is this the end of Kameyama? No.
Because he slams on the brakes and Father Jose is immediately gone, which I personally think he just rolled ass over tea kettle off the car hood and just scuttled away and we just didn't get to see it. Yeah. Father Jose is not allowed to have cool moments and good things.
Kameyama gets out of the car, looks around, and a very real Gomagoo is flying directly to the moon.
God, it's like you can, the green screen of it, like he's clearly standing on one foot just moving his arms as the figure just moves towards the moon. It's spectacular. God, 1 out of 10 could not recommend highly enough.
We got the opening credits. We then cut to the Joint Task Force office. Nozomi is passing out documents that are simply just labeled the Untitled Lifeform Report. And they discuss the fact that they have now tracked ULF-3 flying back and forth between Tokyo and Nagano and wonder why he might be doing that. We too have the exact same question.
Yeah, he picked up a night gig. He works at the 7-Eleven in Nagano.
He has to.
He's got to have a fallback plan, man. Things aren't going well with the Grongi.
No, he's not going to get to play, what was the name of the game that we learned, a Gregel or something like that?
Gigiru.
Gegerol? I'm certain there was an L in there.
Gigiru.
Gegeru.
Gesundheit.
Thank you. He's not getting to play, so yeah, I think he does need to find a night job. And maybe getting away from Tokyo and the toxicity that are the other Gurangi is going to do him some good.
Healthy, you know? And sure enough, he looks healthier this episode. He really does.
He does, and we'll get to that because it's certainly more prominent a little later on.
Mm-hmm.
During this meeting, Sugita, right? It's Sugita who makes the offhand comment about, oh, guess you get to go see your girlfriend again.
He likes boys.
Exactly. Ichijo's even laughing about this.
Who told you?
We then get a close-up on some roughly Polynesian-themed supply store. Tat. It's Popo. Godai seems to have been decorating, and I guess he got his hand on, like, a Pier 1 Imports catalog or something, because he's now going full tropical theme.
Definitely went to, like, a Spencer's Gift and got, like, that cheap, shitty fish lantern where the fish move in a circle so it looks like they're swimming. Like, oh, yeah, we're full Caribbean, baby.
They spent the entire prop budget last episode.
Yeah. All the refunds they got from the G-Men, from the tax guys last episode, it's gone. Pop spent it on shitty tropical fish and Hawaiian shirts.
But Pops and Nana come in. Pops is wearing a rather tropical-looking shirt, and they're talking about Pops going on a vacation to Shona.
Mm-hmm.
And Godai's like, yeah, I want to go. And Nana's like, well, yeah, I want to go too. And Pops makes a pun.
So you do.
And Nana gets upset. She turns to Godai. Godai makes the exact same pun. She is delighted.
It's just not that into you.
No. Person in the conversation I care about said a thing. Yay.
The phone rings. Nana goes to answer it. And it's Jean on the other line. And Nana kind of freaks out and says that she only speaks English, but then doesn't speak any English.
A little bit of English.
Little bit? Does she actually?
She only speaks a little bit of English.
The grammar is wonky, so it can be confusing.
But then Jean is able to get through that he wants to speak to Godai. And Nana's like, oh, phone for you?
I guess.
She is concerned until she hears Godai specifically say the name Jean.
Yeah.
And we find out that Jean and Sakurako are getting ready to go to the police institute to check out the Go-Ram, just like they asked if they could in the last episode.
Yes, they finally completed their large bug puzzle.
Yes. You know who's always at the institute? Inakita. At this moment, though, she's not.
Yeah, speaking of parts of the episode we're ill-equipped to talk about.
We then cut to a bedroom, and Inakita is covered up.
Important to note, it's 3:35 in the afternoon.
Yes. Her mom comes in. Grandma's like, you need to wake up. And she goes, oh, is my son awake? And grandma goes, no, it's 3:30. He's at school. He came in to try and wake you. You didn't do anything. You know, it's really embarrassing because ever since the ULF started, the moms take turns walking the kids to school. I'm the only grandmother who does this.
Yeah.
His mom is just the one developing tech to fight them. How dare she miss escort duty?
Is that what it was? Because maybe it's just me, but I kind of got the impression she was a little depressed. Maybe she's up all night making anti-Grongi weapons, but like the way the scene's presented made me feel like she might be depressed.
She is a workaholic. The fact that, you know, the one time beforehand when we saw her out with her son, Grongi attack, and she immediately went and did that, and when asked about it, just was like, oh yeah, no, job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I fall on the side of this, because I certainly see both arguments, and certainly it is tricky to balance family and career. I struggle with it at moments, and I can only imagine as a single mother it would be even worse for her.
So I think just for the sake of argument, I think we go with the headcanon for our podcast that she is just overworked and sleeping till 4 o'clock in the afternoon because she's up all night making war crimes bullets for the team.
Yes.
But yeah.
This is something I appreciate about this show and in Nakata's story in particular. There is no right answer to this. She's trying but is flawed.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Both is an entirely valid option.
Absolutely. And given that this show is aimed towards, you know, preteens, showing them a realistic depiction of, hey, sometimes sacrifices have to be made on all ends, is probably a good thing. I can't really imagine anything I watched at 12 having had the same message.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we're getting a little off the plot here, but I did want to say that I am pretty proud of this show, you know, it being engineered for 12, 14-year-old kids to deal with some of these topics, to actually have the courage as a writing and directive staff to actually depict them, and having the ability from a writing and directing perspective to present them in a way that is not problematic, but does properly address and properly show some of these internal conflicts. That's something that's really encouraging to me. And it kind of shows like the maturity of the audience this was designed for, as opposed to, you know, Western audiences. We got Code Lyoko when I was 12.
This is a really cool thing about Japanese children shows. They don't talk down to children.
No, absolutely not. No pulling punches. Life is rough immediately. Get in your little business suit, grab your briefcase, and get on the train. Fisher Price accounting set for Christmas.
I think I had that one, actually.
This is a third-hand knowledge thing, so correct me if I'm wrong. But in Japan, they don't have the same limits on what is appropriate for children, and so are able to tackle heavier and more serious toy lines.
Absolutely.
Let's get back to the story here. So we cut to Nagano, and Ichijo is on the phone, and he's talking to one of the heads of the department there, and he's saying that he's waiting for a report that Kamiyama's supposed to send him. And the guy looks around and is like, ah, nope, no Kamiyama, don't see him, I guess I'll let him know when I find him. Hangs up the phone, turns and walks away. Kamiyama has been standing behind him this whole time.
Mm-hmm. Kamiyama gives me like Donna Noble from Doctor Who vibes, like always in the room but never quite being talked to.
But also taken much less seriously.
Oh, for sure.
Ichijo is also flipping through a report that he already got, and he stumbles on an incredibly blurry photo of Labaruba Day, and she's marked as ULF B1. And I believe, Jed, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first time that we've seen the B designation for a ULF.
Yeah, yeah.
So that seems, I'm guessing, to denote human form, because we see in the next page Father Jose, and it's the comments down there on the bottom, ULF B2 eventually confirmed to be ULF 3.
Yeah, those are human form tags, it seems like.
Human forms get B categorization.
Okay. But, you know, speak of the devil, we then also get Goma Goop sauntering jauntily down some stairs.
Yeah, he's full of piss and vinegar today. This just shows the importance of taking care of your mental health, kids. You go to a new city, start a new job, off a couple of co-eds as a large flying bat creature. It does good for your mental health.
Yes.
Producer's note, I can't believe I have to say this, but this podcast does not condone murder.
Goma Goo, the picture grungy of taking care of yourself.
Just imagining, like, You Can Do It kitten posters just with that bat face and a big old thumbs up.
It's Godai's thumb.
It's Godai's thumb from, like, off-camera left.
So he walks down this very long staircase and comes into a tunnel that is lit with clashing red and alien green lighting.
So, okay, but that was cool, all right?
It was. Because I'm not saying it's not.
And that's one of the things that I really like about the show that I've noticed a couple of times is when somebody goes from an emotional state change to another, like he's sauntering down the stairs, he's got the green light, he's all excited, and the green light of his excitedness clashes immediately with the severity of the character that he's now come into contact with. So, like, the light transition served as an emotional transition as well, and that was kind of cool for me.
Judging by Jed's face, that is the look of, you have put more thought into this than the production team did.
Ah.
No, just more than me.
You know what? I like it. Headcanon.
I thought it was Christmas, and there were just red and green lights. Christmas.
But who should he run into? It's Labaruba Day, and she's had a change of wardrobe.
Oh, full tilt.
And hairstyle, like, very drastically different.
Yep, pearl necklaces, white dress, new airbrush rose tattoo on her forehead. Now in pearlescent white.
And she I guess, has tasked him with finding something.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets smart with her for a moment and says, if I'm not doing a fast enough job, have someone else go get it for you.
Yeah, then he gets Blair Witch choked.
Yeah, we get to see her hand transform again. As a reminder, we will never see her full Garongi form.
Nope, just an arm that went through the floral section of Hobby Lobby too fast.
And she tells him that the Go are less forgiving than she is. Oh no. Oh no, 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 no. She throws him to the ground. He says, I'm sorry, I know my place. And she says, you're going to learn your place. And she's not listening to him.
No, he's got peasant status. He's not people like she's people.
I don't think anyone is technically people like she's people. We have not seen another law class Garongi.
Actually, you're right. Huh.
Yet.
Oh.
Hmm.
Well, okay then. So from there we cut to the Institute, and Inokita and another random scientist are looking at pie charts, and this somehow gives them information about the Jinoga clone from last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking amongst themselves again about why did this one dissolve into goo when all of the others have exploded. And they come to the conclusion, although they don't outright say it, it has something to do with the belt.
Yeah, the abdominal
adornment.
Abdominal adornment. I'll never say belt again.
I will continue to say belt.
Okay.
But they point out, like, yeah, all of the explosions seem to have originated from the abdomen. The only thing different we can see about this is that the clone didn't have the belt. So that makes me wonder, if other Garongi didn't have a belt, would they just dissolve into goo instead of exploding?
Hmm.
Who can say? Maybe the show will tell us.
No,
science. The fact that even Jed kind of shrugged, I think, indicates no, they won't.
Yeah, science has now just informed me that if I don't want to explode, I just have to not wear a belt.
I like that.
Yeah. You too can avoid exploding. Yeah, make notes. These are life lessons.
Producer's note. This podcast does not condone not wearing belts as a means of preventing exploding.
But as they're talking, Godai just pops up between the two of them.
Which, considering the room he's in and how long it takes the rest of his party to reach them, he power slid a good 20, 30 feet.
He does a full-on Broadway knee slide across the floor to get there.
Friction burns down to the patella.
There's a reason they only show the camera from, like, the waist up so you don't see just the smears of red down his legs. Godai goes to introduce Sakurako and Jean to Inokita, and she just names them and gives a fact about their food.
Yep.
Oh, you're Sakurako. You like energy drinks more than water. You're Jean. You love pickled plums. Somebody remembers. He cannot eat a meal without them.
It's true. That's why he looks thin these days. He hasn't been able to get them yet.
He's slowly wasting away.
Plum deficiency.
What a tragic way to go.
One could say he's just plum starving. Yeah, you stop typing over that.
We then cut to the Meguro ward, and two random guys are walking out of a convenience store complaining about how they don't get to go out to nightclubs anymore and that other things like this convenience store they just came out of are closing early because of the ULFs, and man, this sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy goes to tie his shoe, and we see the other kind of ragdoll out of frame for a moment.
He's ganked.
Whee! When the one who finishes tying his shoe looks up.
Did you put my wee noise to a soundboard, you son of a bitch? See, the most insulting or most complimentary thing anybody's ever done for me.
That's, it can be two things.
You know what? I'm honored. I'm honored to be on the soundboard. Now we have to assign it to a button.
You're welcome.
So yeah, one guy just gets yoinked off stage right.
When the guy tying his shoe finishes and looks up, he looks around, sees his friend recreating the ending of the Blair Witch Project. He's just standing in a corner, not really a corner, he's facing a pillar. And then he, as if a marionette has just had its strings cut, falls to the ground.
Yep.
The one guy runs over, looks at his friend, his face is discolored.
Like Jean's plums.
And a disembodied voice says that the next victim will be at Komazawa Square.
Hmm. God's now involved.
Yes. So we cut back to the Institute. Sakuraku and Jean are admiring the Go-Ram, which has finished reassembling itself back into its big bad Beetleborgs scarab.
Yeah, the last we saw of it, it was just jelly pooling its way across the floor, that pieces towards each other.
Almost ate Godai because Inokita was in a hurry. Jean-Michel is able to identify Mika's piece and is like, oh good, it is helping. Meanwhile, Godai is looking around, and instead of looking at the obvious script along the gold lining of the back of the scarab, looks down at its foot and is like, hey, isn't that some of those runes you're translating, Sakuraku?
Yeah, I kind of want to know what the motorcycle tramp stamp says, personally.
She pulls out a bulky 2000 digital camera and takes a picture of it. Sakuraku's phone rings. She picks him, like, oh, it's Ichijo, and immediately hands the phone to Godai.
More evidence. Oh, it's Ichijo, boyfriend. Here you go.
Godai picks up the phone. He's like, hey, what's up, boyfriend? And Ichijo says, I need you. And there's a brief pause.
Aw.
This is great. There's been a new ULF attack.
Damn it.
So that was a fucking lie.
Tells Godai to go to Komazawa Square.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ULF attack. We think it might be invisible. A voice was heard, nothing was seen. Upon hearing the comment about we think it might be invisible, Godai has an interesting comment, because he says, like the one that got away that one time.
Yeah, that was an interesting throwaway comment.
So here's some things we know. When Gamma Ray was introduced, he was introduced as Zu Gamma Ray.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the point when Zu Zane Da came in and was mad that the Meh were starting to play the game and he hadn't had a chance yet, Gamma Ray stepped in. And they didn't outright say it, but Gamma Ray's been part of the Meh group since then. The implication there being that he transitioned from Zu to Meh. We have no reference for how that happens, other than the implication that he completed a game.
Yeah, that seems to be the only thing we got. It's also interesting because there's a whole lot of stuff that happens off screen that they chose not to show. And it's an interesting choice, because like we're about to get a time skip where the next ULF we encounter, when they actually number this one, is ULF 31, when Mushroom Mania was, what, 26?
Yes.
So that's a 5 grongi skip in like one episode's worth of movement. And that's an interesting choice, not to just go to the next one, like to have all this off-screen stuff.
The episode of chasing an invisible opponent that they don't catch wouldn't be compelling.
I don't know. I'd consider that pretty compelling. For me personally, like, we see Kuga win and Kuga win and Kuga win. Having an episode where he's going after someone and just doesn't get the job done, to me, would be a little humanizing. And it actually makes these things more of a threat if there's a chance that Godai doesn't always win, you know?
I will certainly give you, you could not do a 2-episode story arc of that, but a single episode, and at the end, having Godai, like, being even more committed to stopping this because I have failed this one time, that would do a lot for the character.
Yeah.
I have no problem with him losing. But an invisible opponent that he can't see is not a compelling villain for that story.
In that regard, I maybe would have picked something other than the chameleon as the one to succeed so that you could have that story.
This reference that Godai is talking about is referring to the ULF they didn't capture, and that was the chameleon completing his game.
Yes, that seems to be what this is implying.
Okay.
You might be able to argue outright saying, but they're requiring you to put the pieces together.
Right.
Since we're talking about him now, let's go ahead and fully introduce Mei Gam Ray, is portrayed by Mori Masaharu. Gam is a corruption of the English word chameleon.
Yes, I frequently refer to my pet chameleon.
But also, again, the fact that we've jumped 5, so there's 4 more Meh-class Gorongi that we haven't seen.
We have another time skip between last episode and this episode, as well as another between these episodes and the next. So our off-screen Gorongi this time are May Gera Ray the frog and may Uzzah die the rabbit killed by Jared's favorite, the splash dragon.
I don't believe you. I have no reason not to. I just choose not to on principle.
Two more of Jetty's hoppy boys.
We also have May Zobi Gee the shrimp and May Gegura Gee the jellyfish killed by Titan Calamity.
We got a what? Jellyfish?
We got Titan kills off screen? We were robbed, boys.
We were.
May Demuto by the ladybug, May Gani die the fox, and May Juma die the zebra were all killed by Mighty Kick.
Okay, these Grongi sound really cool, though.
It's the reason we didn't get them.
We don't have the budget to do the pistol shrimp.
The fight with Mega Berry Goo the Pelican is available in a manga.
Goddamn Pelican Grongi, and I'm gonna put it on my TV.
I'm imagining that he just opens his mouth and swallows people whole as a pelican.
Just imagining Godai's feet just kicking in the air outside of a giant bill.
It looks like the Pikachu when it's stuck in Cramorant. So we cut to the Komazawa Square, and a woman is approaching the entrance down into the subway, holding a briefcase, calling after a person, and we see his limp body on the ground. And a disembodied voice says that the next victim is going to be at Central Tower. The woman drops the briefcase, runs away screaming. We then see Garima Ba walk up, and Gamma Ray materializes into existence. And him doing this seems like the proper moment to bring up this week's Tropusatsu. Hollywood chameleons. So as you know, chameleons famously can change their colors. However, chameleons in fiction really tend to not operate the way chameleons out in nature actually do. So real chameleons have a very limited range of colors that they can change into, and it's primarily dictated by mood. It just so happens to work for camouflage, probably as a, you know, an evolution thing. The ones that weren't able to do it died out because, oh, predators noticed. Bright colored thing against dark drab background. Most chameleons will switch between like greens, dull reds, grays, browns, that sort of a thing. But in fiction, chameleons can just turn straight up invisible.
Oh god, yes. Mm-hmm. Things with chameleon DNA, like it's been addressed a couple of times in Spider-Man where like the lizard in a couple of iterations can just be invisible.
Yeah. And there's not really an animal that can do that. The closest would be like certain types of squids and cuttlefish, but yeah, they're not turning invisible. They're just changing color and texture of their bodies to match the surrounding that happens to be like sand and dirt and gravel on the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, octopi are incredibly talented at it. They can change skin texture, skin color. There are certain deep sea fish that also have chromatophores that can go from having solid color, like being a dark brown or reddish brown fish, to collapsing or constricting those chromatophores and turning just completely translucent so they can be seen straight through. So that's a little closer, but we're also not seeing, like, the deep sea walleye, Grongi, is now here, flopping on the floor. No, we're going with chameleons. And, you know, it is interesting that just invisibility is where they lean to with it.
Yeah. Although I imagine it might be slightly ridiculous if they had gone with a proper, like, cuttlefish Garongi turning invisible.
Are you kidding? After what they did with the hermit crab, I would be all about a flamboyant cuttlefish Garongi.
Actually, yeah, so would I.
Yeah, like dreadlocks, but they're, like, straight up and all different colors, and when he gets mad, they turn red. Hire me.
For the color alone, it would be one of the most impressive Garongi we'd see.
And some of the most impressive CGI in the show. Oh god, I don't trust the show to do that.
So, Garima Ba and Gamma Ray have a brief discussion, and Garima Ba mentions that Labaruba Day is bringing Badu in? That's a name we haven't heard yet.
Mm-hmm.
Go Beta Ba. More on him later.
Yeah, we definitely have some heavy-handed advancements to the plot happening in this episode. We've got a full wardrobe change for somebody that just, like, interacted with our new higher cast of Grongi. And, like, there's new players entering the game. Like, things are afoot.
We cut to Godai.
No, we don't.
No, we don't. Not yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
You will not move past this scene without addressing the fact that the chameleon talks like Mr. Beaker from the Muppets.
Oh.
This was an incredibly intimidating Grongi, just invisible, could blend in perfectly, make no sound, just snap a neck, walk away, done. Incredibly efficient killer. And then he materializes, and the bottom of his mouth stays still while the top flaps like Mr. F***ing Beaker, and all fear of this Grongi left my body. He could be choking me out on the subway, and I would laugh in his face as he tried to murder me.
I mean, you wouldn't see him if he did that, because so far every kill has been while he was invisible.
I'd just be being choked by an invisible villain in my head. All I'd hear is, me, 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 me. You can kill me, but you're not going to take joy in this one, bud. I'm sorry.
Laughing all the way to the grave.
How did you die, Mr. Frickin' Beaker?
I now want to see a dub of Garima Ma and Gamma Ray with Bunsen Honeydew and Beaker.
Oh my god. It would take time, but I could do this. I'd give up a Sunday for that. You don't have much time. The go are on the move. Ah, you're right. We'll get back to your game.
More for our Muppet AU.
Yes.
They don't even have to change him. If we did the, like, replace one person with a live person, everybody else becomes Muppets, he doesn't have to change.
You're right.
We just need to put a fuzzy wig on him.
You know what else would work?
The lab coat.
Beaker is just there beside him and they speak in unison.
He's Beaker's Muppet. Okay, now we can cut to driving.
Okay, so... We cut to Godai driving. We cut to Godai driving, and he receives a call from Ichijo saying, hey, we didn't quite get there in time. There's been another announcement. I need you to get to Central Tower and the Oda Ward now. So we as an audience then cut to Oda Ward, Central Tower, and all of the police are there standing around. We do get confirmation that they've cleared out all of civilians, but that just guarantees that a cop is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you know it, sure enough, all of a sudden, as if being raptured, we get a little bit of wire work pulling the cop up, and then CG of him moving while being perfectly still through the air until he hits the side of the tower and falls to the ground.
Oh, that was CG. I thought that was a really good stunt, man. Weird.
Everyone's looking around. Guns are drawn. Gamma Ray makes his announcement that the next attack's going to happen tomorrow. He's calling it an early night because it's only 6:37 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Sleep hygiene's important.
Taking care of yourself. That is the overall moral of this episode.
You know, it is. Our most successful villains take care of themselves. 6:30, I'm going to stop here, get some dinner, go home, rest, wake up for a full round of killing tomorrow.
Producer's note. Again, and I can't believe I'm saying this twice, this podcast does not condone murder. Even for your mental health.
But we cut to somewhere. Looks old and abandoned, slightly run down. And, oh, hey, it's Nuzai Jorei. We haven't seen him in a bit, and we still don't get a good look at his face.
Mm-mm.
He's brushing dirt off of something with his hands.
Yeah, it looks like a recovered relic, which makes me wonder if this is what Father Jose has been up to, is getting old tech or artifacts or something from that dig site.
I think you're onto something there. Because Labaruba Day and Gomagoo are there as well, and they're kind of discussing about whatever he's doing, it's not ready yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that they need more? It's unclear what exactly he means by that.
Chuck E. Cheese tokens.
Well, I don't think it's immediately after he says that, but it is during this scene. We do see, like, leaf arrowhead pendant thing. It almost reminds me of the claw on Labaruba Dave's ring.
Kinda, yeah.
But while they're talking about this, motorcycle comes in, and a guy in a scarf, kind of a... I kept referring to him as James Dean. It's not James Dean, but it's certainly
it's evocative. It's James Dean-esque.
Evocative, yes. Gets off the bike, walks up. He's flipping a coin. And just as he gets up next to Goma, he flips the coin. grabs it out of the air and also throws a punch at the same time, inches from Goma's face, and he just goes, nope, I'm out.
Yeah, okay, I get it, I'll leave.
And so this is our first look at Gobadaba. Now, you might be thinking for a moment, huh, Gobadaba sounds awfully close to Zubadzuba.
See, for me, it sounded awfully close to Gobadaba. Gobadaba.
Oh, God, we're going to sing that whole song if we don't stop.
Yeah, that's why I arrested myself immediately. So, yeah, very, very similar.
He's not told that he's starting the game, but it seems like that's going to happen for him soon.
Bro, he's flipping a coin as he walks in the room, got the whole James Dean vibe going on, rode in on a motorcycle. His scarf has wind on it at all times. Nobody tells him when to start the game. The game starts when he shows up.
I will accept this.
Mm-hmm. Game just knows better.
So we cut back to Central Tower, and Gomeray appears briefly, and they finally start shooting at him. And he turns invisible again so that we can get a Matrix-esque effect of the bullets hitting him. And we know for a fact these are not the war crime bullets.
Yep. Yeah, actually, in particular, yeah, because you see him impact, like, the invisible skein of where he is, and the bullets are all intact.
Yes. And, like, from the very first episode, we saw that Zygmunt Ba, for all of his many, many shortcomings, was able to stop bullets with his skin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is nothing new. This is just, honestly, a pretty cool shot that we were able to see it this way.
Yeah.
They fall off, he makes himself visible again, taunts them.
Yells, skill issue, and just goes about his day.
And they shoot at the concrete because he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
We get some brief Goma just lying.
Living in the sunlight, traveling in a fun life, having a wonderful time.
He does not live in the sunlight. He might very well love in the moonlight, though. Who can say?
He's got to overinvest in that one because he doesn't have access to the other half of the song.
So Ichijo goes back to his car because he has decided, all right, shooting at nothing is no longer fun. And as it just so happens, the hypersonic detector is picking up Goma again. And he calls out to Godai. And wouldn't you know, Godai's on his bike and is getting flyby'd.
Yep.
By Goma.
Father Jose is like, yeah, boys, that's Kuga.
Godai ends up going inside of a warehouse because, yeah, if he's flying at me, I'll go inside a building. Let's see him fly at me now. And
he flies at him now.
And we get a pretty cool fist fight.
Yeah. This was a pretty cool fight for another reason, too. Me and Jetty were talking while you were, you know, out doing your thing. This was a cool fight because it fundamentally reset power levels. Because Kuga struggled with Father Jose the first time they fought. A second Grungi showed up and he ended up offing one and Father Jose got away. But this was a complete cakewalk for Kuga. Like, Father Jose definitely landed some strikes, but did nothing.
Yeah.
Which makes me think we're about to move. Like, we've got some movement with what we've talked about, but it makes me think that this is the moment that they're preparing us with the show, the director, to move to a higher caliber of villain. This is our
sorting algorithm of evil.
Yeah, 100%. We've reset power levels. We know where everybody's at. Cool, time to move on.
I loved the use of space in this fight. And the use of props. Smashing through boxes. It makes any fight look 10 times cooler, automatically.
That one intern waving the mirror in front of the oscillating fan.
What a weird choice that was. There is a light swinging back and forth from one side to the other constantly.
Yep. Yeah, it was a choice. It was a little distracting, honestly.
And then, right as Godai is getting ready to do his rider kick, some electricity sparks off his leg, and he, like, looks down being like, this is different.
Yeah, Dorothy, you gotta click your heels first. The ruby slippers don't work.
And motorbike comes in. And it's Bada-ba.
Mm-hmm.
And he stands there, model-esque pose, flips the visor up on his helmet.
Oh, no, he's high!
Trademark mole and everything.
Yes. And he looks at Godai and says, effectively, my turn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of this episode.
You know, I don't think he would even look back at that cool explosion.
No.
He would just keep walking away slowly.
His scarf blowing in a breeze that only he has, because it is happening. They're inside a building.
Warehouse. Yes, yes, his scarf is blowing in the warehouse. Yet flicking a cigarette, none of us saw him pick up.
Let's get to the next episode.
Please, let's go.
So I'm of mixed feelings about this episode.
Oh, I loved it. We got to see another Nerf action sequence.
It's true. That was very good. All right, let's take it from the top. So we start the episode with a slight reshoot of the way the last episode ended.
Mm-hmm. This time we got our motorcyclist, Bada, coming straight on in through some... Through some plywood boards. Yeah, some debris, some boards.
Smashes right through, charges straight at Godai. He leaps over, skids to a halt. He pauses standing there. His scarf is limp. He is inside the building. A breeze starts to blow, and his scarf gets caught in it.
I'm telling you, Jared, the breeze comes with the scarf. If you pay for a high enough quality scarf, the breeze comes with it.
He did.
Yeah. Spare no expense.
And then he's just like, later, nerd, and gets back on the bike and drives off.
Is the bat gone? Cool. Fuck you. Bye.
And Godai looks around and is like, God damn it, Father Jose. I
keep falling for that.
Credits. Mm-hmm. We then cut to the riverbank. Ichijo and Godai are there, and Godai apologizes for not killing Goma. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to believe he is apologizing to us as much as to Ichijo.
Yeah, this is the second time he's fought Batman, now fully in control of his brand new power set. Still hasn't finished him off.
No. They talk a bit more about what they're going to do moving forward. We cut to Central Tower. And Sugita's there. He picks up a bullet off the ground. And it's got some film over it. It's
powder.
Like it is greenish. Very reminiscent of the same powder that Gigagi had. Mm-hmm. We're going to find out that it's not the same thing, but it looks the same.
Yeah.
And Ichijo calls him, and they have a quick talk about, hey, we're going to send this to the lab, see what Inokita can get figured out. We cut to the lab.
Speaking of lab.
Yes. And Jean-Michel and Sakurako are examining the Goram. They're currently underneath it as if to give it an oil change.
Mm-hmm.
Taking pictures of all of the script that they can see etched into it.
Yeah, the script on the bottom is much more out of focus when we take a picture of it. Not relevant, but funny.
And Inokita gets a phone call. And this upset me. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, she gets a phone call from Grandma. Grandma basically reminds her, hey, you were supposed to help your son with his little art project. He was really looking forward to that. Where are you? With John and Sakurako standing there just like leering over her shoulder, she proceeds to say, hey, I'm really sorry. I'm stuck at work. There's another ULF. Like, I can't come home right now. Can you do it? And this seems to bother John, because even when Sakurako like goes to like pull him away, like, hey, we should give them some privacy. He's just kind of staring over his shoulder, like, you know, kind of pouting into the middle distance a little bit. So, yeah, I think we've confirmed from last episode she's just really, really overworked and exhausted, which is honestly almost a worse option in terms of, like, you know, her kiddo. The kid's really depressed. He had a cute little tiger cutout that he was going to build with mom, and then he goes to sit on the couch and do it himself, and we move on from there.
So we cut to Ichijo and Godai. Ichijo is in his car. Godai's on his bike. Nozomi gives a call saying that they've found two potential locations for where the Gorongi hideout could be. Ichijo confirms that Godai heard this and tells him, hey, I will take one, you take the other.
Confirms that Godai heard this not sitting in the same car with his helmet on, his magical police dirt bike on, and no earpiece in.
Yes.
Okay. Open comms. Got it.
All Gundam comms style. Are open comms. Yes. So they split up. We then cut to a diner in Kashiwa Ward.
Where we confirm a long-told but never seen piece of Jean mythology.
Yes.
They're on the table as they eat.
Are his plums.
Are the goddamn pickled plums.
And Jean is very sullen, but still continuously eating.
Mm-hmm.
Sakurako's like, hey, are you okay? You were excited up until just a little bit ago. And Jean-Michel says, when you make a promise to a child, you should keep it.
Hmm. Maybe this has something to do with how Jean ended up emotionally dead Muppet who only eats when there are pickled plums nearby.
Very well could be. We cut to the side of a river. Nichijou is walking along the bank sneakily. And wouldn't you know it, at the base of a set of stairs, he finds a rose petal.
Mm-hmm. Just a single one.
He makes his way up and into the building and is stealthing his way in. He hears a noise, inches towards the door, and a quick scan, we see that Megurimaba, Nuzai Jorei, and Megamare are there. And Nuzai Jorei gives a double-sided sword, like the one that Sazabi had in the original Gundam.
That's a deep cut. Don't shake your head. Pokemon reference in a minute. Calm down. We know our audience.
It's
big and curved, swooshy.
Slightly curved sword. And another one attached to the bottom. The curves go in opposite directions, so it forms an S.
Yeah, and it's one of those.
He gives it to Megurimaba, and she says that this is going to be perfect for when she assumes the title of Gogurimaba.
Mm-hmm. Big and aspirations.
Megamare is like, no, I'm going to be Gogamare. The only thing that matters is, you know, the kills. And there's some trash talking about what's the most important thinking. Thing is.
Yeah.
And Labaruba Day, who has been just off camera, walks in and is like, you only get to be a Go if you win your game.
Well, darn it.
Ichijou goes to leave, and this is the first time that he has watched the Gurangi, and his phone has not gone off giving his location away.
Oh, God, he definitely didn't think to do it either. He just got lucky.
Yeah, no. He makes it out, but Labaruba Day used extreme speed. Because she's there.
Mm-hmm.
And in Japanese, she says to him, the Lindo sure have changed. And he draws his gun and tells her to freeze. And she uses, what was it, Petal Storm?
I think it's Petal Blizzard.
Petal Blizzard.
Yeah.
It looked like Rose Screamer from G Gundam.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, Ichijou takes a bunch of rose petals to the face.
And he goes down.
Like a wet sack of potatoes.
He then wakes up in his car.
To see Godai's smug, smiling, stupid puppy dog face 6 inches from his.
This is definitely fruity.
And Godai tells him, I went to my place, didn't see anything, so I came to check on you and found you laying on the ground.
Godai gives off the same energy that Solo used to give off. We're just loyal to the point of being stupid about it. Like, I remember the time he ran through, like, a second-story window to follow you to school. That is how Godai approaches life. Big, I ran into the door until it broke energy.
Solo is my old dog for you listeners.
So, I mean, I think, because Godai once rescued Ichijou before and then just sort of laid him on top of himself outside, we didn't really see the conversation afterwards, but I'd like to believe that Ichijou may have said something about, like, you couldn't have put me in a more comfortable place, and Godai, being a caring boyfriend, is like, oh, I remember this. I'll take him to his car.
Yeah. He happy there. We spend a lot of time in car.
We do. Car good. We cut back to the Institute, and Inokita is looking at cells.
Like slides on a microscope. Yeah.
And she's commenting about how when red light is shown on them, they turn red. When blue light is shown on them, they turn blue. These are the debris that was found on the bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And we have determined that these are like skin cells of gamma ray. And that, oh wow, they are perfectly photochromatic. Is that the correct term for it?
Chromatophoric.
Chromatophoric, yes, thank you. And she, after talking about all this, looks out the window, squints at the sun, and then says, oh man, I pulled another all-nighter. And we get a quick cut back to her house where her son is in bed. Grandma's next to him, and he rolls over slightly. And I was so afraid that they were going to have him, like, whimper mom before they cut away, and I'm so grateful that they didn't. We cut to Pol-Pol, and Pops is there. Minori's there, because he's, I'm so grateful you're here. Yusuke hasn't been seen in ages. He doesn't work here anymore. I'm not going to get rid of his bed. He'll sleep in the street otherwise. And even if I change the locks on the doors, he'll just come in through the window.
Yeah, I can't keep him out, honestly. It's either a cot or a wake up next to me.
and Nana's got all day acting lessons.
And she comes in and shows off what she learned. This one's called Sad.
Nana comes in distraught, and Pops is like, hey, you were supposed to be gone all day. What happened? And Nana reveals that her acting teacher was killed by Galma Ray.
Yeah. We've tiptoed around this phenomenon before in the series, but I don't think we've had another hit this close to home. Like, I kept being terrified anytime we flipped to the kids at the school that, like, when one of their parents was late, it was because they were got by one of the ULFs and we were going to have to deal with that. This is the first time we've really had somebody peripheral to the main cast. Like, this has affected somebody other than Godai and Ichijo and the main characters.
Yes. We've sort of had one, but it was more retroactive, mm-hmm. where they confirmed that, you know, one of the cops that Mebio killed, you know, oh, here was his life and here's how it intertwined with us. Mm-hmm. And it is now sad that he's gone. Mm. But yeah, this is the first directly a ULF killed someone that I know and care about for our main cast.
Yeah.
We cut to Chiyo Plaza and Sugita and Ichijo and a whole bunch of other cops there because this is where Galma Ray has announced that his next kill is going to be. And Sugita mentions that Sakurai is on his way with the flash grenades. I guess Inokita informed them that a particularly bright light will undo his camouflage, but it only lasts for 5 minutes.
How we know 5 minutes specifically? Unclear.
My guess is she did something with those cells.
She trades a whole night all the way till dawn in exchange for plot-relevant science information.
Yes.
Like it's her job.
Yes.
Very aggressive science and child neglect. Two things.
All of a sudden, a cop ragdolls. Mm-hmm. Gets pulled, slams into something. It looks almost like he hits like a counter with his waist, but his face also smushes some. Falls over.
Yep.
Galma Ray makes his announcement. He's like, oh, look how many people you brought here. This is wonderful. Makes you so easy to kill. What a wonderful game. Sugita's like, what are you talking about, game? And we finally get a bit of information for what this is, and it is quite literally just a game. The game is to see if you can kill a set number of Linto while following the rules that have been established for you. Nothing more, nothing less. The predator going after the prey.
Ooh, and the prey takes this personally.
Ah, Sugita gets very upset about this and says there's got to be more to it than that. Nope.
This reveal would be a lot more impactful if we hadn't had the grungy subtitles.
That's true.
Interesting, yeah. And you said that when the series first came out, they didn't have subtitles for the grungy, so people just had to figure this out as they went along. Ooh, yeah, this would have been a much more impactful drop if we hadn't known what they were saying the whole time. That's interesting.
It's still really cool to have it, like, them finally catch up. But man, for us to learn it at the same time that the cast did, maybe we did ourselves a disservice.
I don't know.
Nah, oh well. Another cop gets ganked. And this time they show that his face slams into a ripple. So Galma Ray is grabbing them and pulling them into himself.
Big hug.
Yes.
Or headbutt. We don't know. We don't get enough visual information to know, but he's grabbing them and slamming them into something.
We quickly cut away. Godai is on his bike. Oh, man. I just realized I skipped over something. At Jonin University, Godai and Sakurako have a quick conversation. He's like, hey, you've been able to translate anything for the Goram. And she gives him a translation that cuts to roughly like, in the moment of need, the warrior and the messenger, the Goram, will join hands and take off towards a grand future. And he's like, I don't know what that means, but okay.
He takes it so stupidly literal, and I love this golden retriever boy for this.
He does initially ask if it tells him where to place his feet, which I love.
Take hands, but where do I put my tootsies? I don't know. Read the... Mm.
Godai is heading towards Chuyo Plaza, and he remembers a bit more of that conversation with Sakurako that we got earlier, where she informs that the word for future can also be read as flight.
I miss Father Jose.
finally, we're back at Chuo. Sakurai shows up, and he pulls out the case of stun grenades. And Sugita and Ichijo both grab one, toss them, they go off. Gamera is no longer invisible. Mm-hmm. Now I guess they're using the war crime bullets, because they're shooting at him, and he just runs. He's, I guess, a coward. If he can't be invisible, he doesn't want to stay around.
Oh, snap.
As Gamera is running away, Godai pulls up on the bike, untransformed. Mm-hmm. And Gamera's like, who are you? He transforms into Kuga. They start fighting. It's a all right fist fight by, honestly, I don't think it's a pond. I think it's it rained before filming and just hadn't properly drained yet. Mm-hmm. As they're doing this, Ichijo runs up and is like, hey, he's not going to stay visible for much longer. And right as Godai goes to do the rider kick, wouldn't you know, time's up and he's able to turn invisible again.
And Zoidberg's right the hell out of there. I heard it in my head.
Godai's like, this is perfect. I already know what I'm going to do. Super transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes into Pegasus mode. Ichijo tosses him his gun. We get a great shot of him standing there just holding the gun for a moment before it transforms into the bow gun. And the Go-Ram shows up. And it's interesting. The Go-Ram, at least according to the subtitles, speaks in Gorongi.
It does. That was interesting, yeah.
And says, you know, sorry I'm late, master. So the Go-Ram lifts up, lowers its arms. Godai grabs the arm. They hover up into the air. He scans around because Pegasus mode has great, you know, senses.
Mm-hmm.
Finally locks on where Gamera is.
Gotcha, bitch!
Yes. Gotcha, bitch. It's nerf or nothing, baby. And shoots him.
Symbol appears. Mm. Invisible man becomes visible.
He big staggers explosion. Out in front of the cops.
Yeah.
Big explosion. No chunks. Nothing. He's gone.
Yeah. Bits, if anything. No chunks.
He did the monster mash. The monster mash.
Jetty, is it time to discuss being rammed into by something hard and invisible?
Megamray doesn't do much for me one way or another. He's got the crazy eyes but doesn't seem like he's the fun type of crazy. He is a good sport, so he'd probably be up for anything you'd want to try. The tongue does pose some interesting potential for hijinks.
Hmm.
You know I was going to give him a mash either way just because I didn't have a real reason to pass, but I might have sold myself with the tongue.
Yeah, I could see it.
I would have assumed you would take the stance of pass unless given a reason to mash, but okay, glad to know it's the opposite.
Yeah, no, formatively, we're looking for reasons to pass. It's a baseline of acceptance, and then if we see some red flags, we go the other way.
Noted for the future.
Look, it's been a dry spell, and I'm getting desperate.
Tongue turn you into a Yoshi.
On a rooftop.
Moving right along.
On a rooftop, Godai and Ichijo have a quick talk. Godai is feeling optimistic about the future. End of episode. So, we've got some responsibilities.
Yeah, sure, let's do those.
What are we going to pick as our scale?
I would like to suggest plums.
Yeah, I'm for it.
Okay, yeah.
Before we start rankings, we're going to have some changes in terminology going forward. What we usually referred to as plan will now be called methodology, while personality will now be behavior. This will hopefully broaden our views on these from here on out.
All right, so, Gamera, I guess, behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've seen him for quite a while now. And he has, of course, the Gorongi bravado, the baseline that they all do. He's shockingly more deserving than some of the others, given that he actually has completed his game. Or A1, the one that got him promoted to Meg Group. But he's also not the most braggadocious of the Gorongi. And when he's actually in his monster form, some of the stuff he says just sort of falls flat for me. Particularly that line about die at the tongue of Megamere. Like, you didn't think that through before you said it. It sounded better in your head, didn't it?
Spend a lot of time invisible, you know?
I'm not crazy about him, but I also don't dislike him. I think he's kind of just baseline behavior. He gets a bit of a bump for having completed a game. The fact that I guess he is, in fact, the one Gurungi that got away. So, 3.5.
Okay.
Design. The fact that his human form has not changed since he became a meh from the zoo, I've noticed that meh Gurungi, their human outfits, really have aligned more with their monstrous nature.
Mm-hmm.
The zoo's sorta, but not so much. His falls into that category. The platinum hair, the black and chrome, that doesn't imply or indicate to me chameleon. There could have been choices. Hell, tie-dye, even, would have been an interesting choice to go with for that. His monster form is lackluster. The head sculpt at least changes the silhouette slightly, but it is a solid piece, and that beaker mouth flap is...
distracting.
Yes. He's got the diapy, he's got a collar.
Not this time.
No diapy? Oh, again, I'm like sight blind to their pelvis at this point. I assume they all have them. Again, fine, but not much there. I think this one's just going to be a solid 3 for me. Methodology. This one gets points because he is he's doing something different in that he's making his announcements, and even the other Gurungi kind of find it odd that he's doing this. He says to show that he's worthy of being a go, which makes me wonder, is that a thing they're gonna do? I guess we'll find out soon enough. Mm-hmm. Maybe they abide by a different set of rules, just like the Meg get to abide by a different set of rules than the zoo. That makes sense that the go get to do something different, and maybe he's attempting to punch above his weight class this way. Who can say? The strangling people while invisible is effective and horrifying. To just look over and see someone suspended slightly higher than they should be and then collapse in a pile. Whew. This one I'm going to give a 4. So with a 3, a 3.5, and a 4, that brings my total to a 3.5.
So for me, this character was, at least in terms of behavior, dead middle of the road. Does have that, like you said, that cosmic arrogance that all the Gurungi have. This one is a little more justified, since if we take our extrapolations and our interpretations of what we think they're referring to in the series, yeah, he's the only person that's completed a game, he's the only one that actually has bragging rights, but he still seems a little too big for his britches at times. Other than that, there's just not a whole lot that we're given. He's pretty condescending, he's a little more laissez-faire with what he's willing to say. He speaks Japanese, and he's willing to give away some plot points to the cops, which is, you know, our revelation that this is a game that they catch up to. But yeah, I'm going to give him a bog standard 3 for methodology. Yeah, absolutely. Chameleon murder, absolutely terrifying. And something we didn't discuss, but something that I think is of note, is that it doesn't just appear to be visual changes, because nobody hears him either until we get to Pegasus form. Pegasus is able to track him down. But in the scenes in which we see him off people, there's no other sound. Like, we don't hear boots scuffing on the ground. We don't hear anything else. So, like, he's got a lot of chameleonic traits. He's got a lot of stealth. And, like, that comes through in his methodology. It's absolutely horrifying. I think you're on the right track with the additional requirements. Maybe to complete higher tier games, you have to, you know, self-impose additional rules and restrictions, like announcing to spectators of your crimes where the next one will take place. That gives, you know, some advantage, some ability to maybe counterplay you, so it requires a little more skill to complete this game. So I think you might be onto something, that he's trying to, you know, reach beyond his current status. So I'm going to give methodology a 4. As far as aesthetic, not great. This is one of the more colorful Gurungi we've seen, but even that didn't really save it for me. The disconnect between the headpiece and the shoulders was very distracting. Like, every time he turned his head, you'd see a big gap open up between what was supposed to be the necklace around his neck and the skin of his shoulders. So that was a little distracting. There was even a part where he like goes to stand up after being knocked in the puddle where the actor playing him had his hands on his head as he stood back up in a way that kind of visually indicated to me that the helmet was about to fall off and he had to hold it on while he was standing up. The beaker mouth, hella distracting, didn't contribute anything meaningful to the character and did not say chameleon to me. I've never seen a chameleon with a beaker mouth and I'm now terrified that's going to haunt my nightmares. Yeah, 1.5, honestly, pretty low. Like, this was not one of my favorites. I did notice we didn't have a diaper, but even the head silhouette reminded me of Rocksteady, our Rhino character. It was like they used the same mold for both and then just made some slight modifications. So, didn't really feel particularly original. Didn't really feel like a chameleon. It was green. That's about it. Both in the human characteristic, you're absolutely right. There was nothing that spoke chameleon to me from the human aesthetic. And from the chameleon aesthetic, it was just green. There's so much you could do with a chameleon, both in human form and Grungy form. Chameleons are characterized by those wacky eyes that point in different directions. No nod. Nothing. So I feel like there was a lot of wasted opportunity on this one. That brings me to a 2.833. Repeating, of course, Plums.
Megam Ray's design is average. The bold green is nice, but color has been less of an issue in recent Grungy. I will give him points for a moving mouth, which I kind of like. And sure, chameleon camouflage not working the way it does here is true. This is a tried and true chameleon monster power. But that's just it, it's not innovative like some of the other Grungy we've seen. Even his human form is pretty tame. And aside from the vest sort of having a scale pattern, it's not particularly thematic. It's not a bad design, but it isn't great either. He gets a 3. Now his personality or behavior is something else. We see that cockiness, but it's cranked up to 11 with him, makes sense as he is the only Grungy to have won his games so far. But that leads him to what is arguably sportsmanship-like behavior in announcing his next attack. It's no fun if there isn't a bit of challenge. But it is also him toying with victims and the police because they can't stop him. He even torments them with the knowledge of the game. Add in his weird head moves and crazy eyes since his introduction and he is a fun character, one of the most enjoyable Grungy in fact. 4.5. His methodology is grab someone with his tongue, kill them, announce his next killing, rinse repeat. Since he's invisible for his killings, they aren't really impactful. And while announcing his kills makes him an interesting character, it doesn't make him a successful one. It's always a bad idea to tip your hand like that. I won't hold it against him too much, just because if he hadn't done that we wouldn't have had much of a story this episode. I'll give him a 2 for methodology. That brings my composite to 3.16 repeating.
Which brings our total score for this Grungy to 3.164 plums.
All right.
Which is what Jean would consider an appetizer.
I like that it's almost pie, plums. Episode. So, plot. I'm of two minds, the plot for these two episodes. I really liked the first episode. The second episode is a mix for me. There were parts of it I liked, and there are parts of it that all of the stuff with the Inakita just hits me in a way that honestly is uncomfortable to put into words to try, but, you know, I've said it before, as a parent, this affects me, I guess, obviously different than it would you guys. We had the discussion about how it is realistic, and that's cool that they're showing that, but when, you know, this is a product that I am ideally watching for escapism and enjoyment, hits too close to home for me.
This is unfortunately her story for the season.
Brace yourself, bucko.
I will try. I'm at a loss to put coherent words to my feelings as a whole about these two episodes, so forgive me for being vaguer than I normally am. I think 2.5 for plot. Cinematography. They were ambitious. We got a lot of bad green screen in these two. But that's a product of its time, and I'm trying not to hold that against it in the way that I may have. We got some great footage of fights, which I will talk about more when we actually get to combat. Their ambition is marred somewhat by technology and budget at the time. I do feel these kind of end up balancing each other out. Three. Combat. I actually really liked the combat this pair of episodes. We got some great up-close and personal fights. Zugo Magoo in the warehouse. Great use of space. Great use of camera, even with the annoying light swinging back and forth. They took advantage of the environment, interacting with the props inside there. Even the, albeit brief, fist fight with Galmaray, having the splashes in water, really added something to it. And Blast Pegasus is so clean and smooth. You may not agree, but I loved that. I'm going to give this high praise 4.5. So the 2.5, a 3, and a 4.5... That brings my score to 3.3 repeating.
So for me, I'm going to echo some of the stuff you said. The things with Inokita didn't hit me the same as they hit you. Makes sense. I feel guilty when we leave our dog in the kennel for an hour while we run to Walmart. So I can only imagine what it's like to be afraid that you'll neglect your kid or to be afraid that you won't be there for them as much as you want to be. And I can see how that would affect somebody watching it on the screen in real time. It becomes very personal. So I didn't have that emotional connection to the episodes, but I'm still going to rate this plot pretty high. We got a lot of new information, a lot of new motion in terms of the Grongi, their hierarchy structure. We got new weapons introduced. We got new aesthetics introduced. We had characters coming back. These episodes move the plot along. Like, we had our break episode last week. Now it's time to get to work. It's time to get back on track. And they definitely did that. So for me, the plot's going to be a 3.5. I might not have liked, like, some of the fight scenes in this were pretty cool, not necessarily with the chameleon, but, you know, with Father Jose. But, like, the plot itself woven throughout these episodes did move forward. So I'm going to go with a 3.5. Cinematography is also going to hit a 3.5 for me, because you're absolutely correct. There was some green screen CGI. There were some visuals that didn't make much sense. Like the way he was holding the Golem as it lifted him up and then was able to one-handed shoot with the Pegasus finisher across several miles of sky and open terrain and one-handed holding onto a helicopter bug, make that shot on the first try. I'll suspend my disbelief. But in terms of cinematography, given the limitations of technology of the day, there were still some very cool things that we got to see and got to watch. Some very interesting lighting choices. Maybe you guys are right. Maybe that was an unintentional lighting choice with Father Jose coming down the stairs all optimistic and running into the red light and like that changing the mood of the scene. But that worked for me. Intentional or not, it did. So I'm going to give cinematography a 3.5. Combat is going to spike all the way up to a 4. This is the first episode in a while where I felt we had some very strong hand-to-hand combat. We had vehicle combat that was not initiated by Kuga, so that was something special. We got to see somebody else bike Fu at Kuga, and I think that's why he was really surprised. It's like, this is my thing. What's happening? Combat was very strong. Chameleon Boy, not so much. We got to see some cool things. Honestly, the cinematography on the tongue was better than a lot of the transformations that we see on a weekly basis. But we did get some cool Father Jose fights that reestablished power levels for our characters, so... Yeah, combat for me is going to come in at a 4, which is going to take my total to 3.66 plums, repeating. How about you, Jed?
This is another episode where I felt the plot wasn't quite robust enough to fill a full 2 episodes. There isn't much story to Gam's game, and Inokita's story is not only repetitive with her last one, it also doesn't change her situation at all. It involves Jean in it, but that doesn't amount to much either as of yet. So the episodes feel like a lot of spinning wheels. Don't get me wrong, I think Inokita and Jean both do good jobs with what they have, but they don't have much. 2.5. My first note for cinematography is they remember Jean's plums for the restaurant. There is a lot of bad CG in this episode, and I don't want to be too harsh because there are technical limitations it just really showed here. But they make up for it in other places. The framing for Go Beta Ba's entrance is beautiful and striking. They had some nice camera tricks for Glame disappearing when not relying on CG. They also did a really good job building suspense in the showdown with cops with full 360 pan and close-ups on watches scored by a ticking clock. I think I'll go with a 4 here. We have two fights in this episode. The first between Kuga and Goma is actually pretty good in my opinion. It's hard to have a one-sided fight without it feeling boring, but they managed to keep it entertaining while showing how Kuga has advanced in the last 20 episodes. The second fight, however. Much like Jared doesn't like Dragon, I don't like Pegasus. The suit looks nice, but the sniper gimmick does not make for interesting combat. I'm not a fan of energy blasts in the first place, but the franchise makes gun-based forms much better as soon as next season. I think they'll average out to a 2.5. That brings my combined score to a 3.
Which brings our total score for these two episodes to a 3.32 even. 3.32 plums. Snack size.
Yeah.
Honestly, though, I really did enjoy these episodes a lot. Like, I know I had some fairly harsh critiques about Mr. Chameleon Man, and it came through in my score, but genuinely, good episodes, good forward momentum on the plot, even if there were some places we wished it could have been a little more robust. John's going to have a sad boy backstory at some point about his childhood. I can just feel it coming.
All right. With that being said, join us next week when we will be watching episodes 23 and 24 on Uneasiness and Strengthening.
You can reach us by email at commentarytrack@gmail.com or on Twitter at commentarytrack. You can support us at patreon.com/thecommentarytrack. For $5 a month, you get access to special bonus episodes. November's bonus covers the first episode of the original series.
So, you know, chameleons,
they're a form of lizard.